Yeah, I think we have the wrong leadership heroes, the wrong business and leadership heroes. I think artists should be our leadership heroes.
Welcome to Overshare, a podcast and event series where I have honest conversations with creative people I admire about the struggles that often come along with being a creative professional. I'm Justin Genak. I'm your host and also the co-founder of Working Not Working. For those of you not familiar with Working Not Working, we're a curated community that connects companies with the universe's most respected, most awarded, and hardest working creatives in advertising, design, production, and tech. If you consider yourself one of those top creatives or want to hire those types of people, sign up and join us at workingnotworking.com. Now, today's episode is my interview with Yancey Strickler, one of the co-founders and former CEO of Kickstarter. This is easily one of my favorite Overshare conversations yet. I feel so fortunate when I meet someone and they have the ability to change my perspective, and Yancey is definitely one of those people. Yancey has so many insights from the last decade of his life dedicated to Kickstarter, taking it from a simple idea with his two co-founders to a platform that has generated more than $3.5 billion in funding for more than 125,000 creative projects. That's insane. Anyway, I'm really excited for you to hear this. There's so many nuggets in here, from Yancey's rule of believing in everything, because it's way more fun than believing in nothing, to the benefits to his ego after seeing an astrologist in his first day after Kickstarter. Also the importance of putting more love into the world, and to his reason behind growing a mustache inspired by the Beatles to help him write his ambitious book/manifesto about challenging the dominance of financial maximization as the driving force of society. It's definitely a tall task, so I feel like anything helps, even if that anything is a mustache. But the thought behind it and him going incognito is pretty interesting. I've already re-listened to this conversation twice in the past day, and I've gotten more out of it each time, and I'm sure you will too, so please enjoy. Here's Yancey Strickler.
I was going to tell you, you left meeting the Obamas out of that bio.
Yeah, it's a photo op. I don't think that counts. I think it's like they have someone has to ask for your number to count as meeting. That's my bar. It didn't happen.
They have to remember meeting you as well.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's a component. Yeah.
Okay, fine, fair enough. How are things going?
Great. It's nice to see you all. How are you all doing? It's snowing outside. And it's someone just got back from South by Southwest, and I always remember coming back to New York after South by would be like spring was starting, and instead you get snow.
Not at all. Snow. Just like that smack of reality.
Sorry about that.
So I'm going to do some really simple warm-up questions just to like ease us into it. Who's your favorite Beatle?
Oh, it's like an hour. Paul.
Okay.
It's changed at different periods of my life. Never been Ringo, but yeah, now it's Paul. I have a lot of Paul stories. Yeah.
I know you're a big basketball fan, so favorite NBA team?
Houston Rockets.
See, I wore this because I knew he was a basketball fan. And then on the way here, I realized this might have been a bad call. Either he's like cool with the Celtics or just going to agitate him through the entire interview. So you're all right with the Celtics? Or are we like, you just beat us like a week ago. So.
Yeah, I don't think you're relevant.
Okay, cool. Thanks. Jeez. Right now, we're not yet. Favorite basketball player of all time?
Hakeem Olajuwon.
Favorite current basketball player?
James Harden.
Okay.
Yeah, laughs. I heard the laughs.
Have you ever seen him without the beard?
Y'all don't know. Sure.
Yeah?
Yeah, totally.
I haven't looked that up. I feel like I should.
He has made... there are State Farm commercials on television that air during NBA games that Chris Paul is a star of. Chris Paul is now a member of the Houston Rockets. And so Chris Paul's teammates get to star. So James Harden, another member of this team that I love, is also in these commercials. The distinctive thing about James Harden is he has a gigantic beard. Just a huge beard, and he had commercials early in his career where he talked, and he just seemed kind of lame. And I always thought, like, with this giant beard, his brand should just be mystique. Like, does he ever speak? He's like Penn and Teller or something like that. And in the State Farm commercials, it's more like that.
Yeah.
So I feel like
just
his brand
back,
is on the right track. It's just like a mysterious beard.
He's getting it together. That's good.
Anyway.
Favorite curse word?
Yeah, fuck, I guess. Yeah, okay. I thought about shit I thought about for a minute. But I think I went with fuck. Yeah.
I'll probably say that we should have a drinking game every time I say shit during this. We'll go to the basics. Where are you from, and did you grow up in a creative household?
I'm from outside of Blacksburg, Virginia, which is Southwest Virginia, Appalachia. My father plays music, plays country music, and so he taught me how to play guitar early on. I didn't like it. I didn't appreciate it. It was annoying. But when I was like 12, I started love playing guitar for the first time because I learned how to play Blackbird, the Beatles song, and that was like, I was playing music that I liked, and that was like the first time that it happened. So that was always present. I also played in a band with my father for a year, a band he had called Rock Bottom. Their drummer broke his wrist, and so his 12-year-old son filled in, which tells you how good the band was. But we did.
Did you even play the drums?
Grateful Dead. Yeah. Now is my first time playing the drums. We did Grateful Dead covers, Marshall Tucker Band, country and western.
Amazing.
Yeah.
When's the reunion?
Postponed indefinitely. Yeah. Indefinitely postponed due to slow ticket sales. But. One day.
So what was it like in outside of Blacksburg, Virginia?
Just real country. I grew up in a place called Clover Hollow and on a working farm and, very conservative, beautiful, sparsely populated place.
Did you have to work on the farm?
I did. We didn't own the farm. We rented the house. There were farmers who owned it, but I would work for them in the summers doing things. It was a place that I hated at the time. I didn't, like, my closest neighbor was a mile away, so I just read books all the time, played Legos, but mainly read. Now it feels very like a really powerful thing to have been able to experience that and to live there for 18 years. And I've been in New York for the last 18 years. And that mix is really special. Just a very different environment. And one that, is still is like very much a part of my soul and how I think about things.
Do you go back often?
The standard three times a year, two to three times a year.
And then did you go to school for writing, or is that just something that happened?
My dream was always to write. In fourth grade, I wrote a series of science fiction novels for myself and like composition books. There are 8 volumes of this one story. It was reading All the President's Men when I was maybe 13, which is the Woodward and Bernstein book about discovering Watergate, that like made me think, okay, journalism is what I want to do. So I got hot on that. And while in high school, I like interned at a local paper, and then went to college. In college, I studied writing and cultural theory. I just, liked to read and think critically and got a degree of some kind through that. I don't really know what it represents.
Where'd you go?
Except time. A school called William & Mary. Mm-hmm. And then after that, I came here. And so that time there was, kind of finding myself a little bit. It really feels like a waste of time in retrospect, although I read a lot of great stuff.
Yeah.
And then I moved to New York on kind of a lark. My best friend in high school gave me a phone call to say he and 5 other people were moving to New York from Vassar. Did I want to join them? And if so, I needed to be here in like 2 days.
And start paying rent.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the desperation we need to fix.
Yeah, absolutely right. And I said yes. Up to the point in my life, I've never been a person who would say yes to a question like that. But very intentionally thought, like, want to make a different choice here. And then I've been here since.
Did you grow up having aspirations of living in New York, or did that just
I did after when I'm in where I've growing up with my family, I wasn't aware of that. But this friend who I moved here with, I met him when I was 15. We met at a magnet school, like a gifted school, where we both went for half a day. And it was my first time being around people I connected with. And so I started going home with him, and his parents were artists from New York. And I just had no idea that existed.
Yeah.
And I just saw it and immediately just thought, yeah, this is what I want. And I remember I would like read Talk of the Town in the New Yorker while being at their house and like dream of this society life. And, you know, I'd watch Woody Allen movies and just think, yeah, I want to be about that.
Yeah.
And yeah, that was just, it's just like what I aspire to. It's the same reason, you know, there's like a cool record store in town. Music was always the center of my life. There's a cool record store in town and I would buy things just because of what the cool people who worked there liked, and I wanted them to think I was cool, you know? And
that's
like,
most of us do it.
Yeah, that's why we do almost everything.
That's why I bought this sweatshirt.
Yeah.
Just to impress you.
So that was, I don't know. So I've been here ever since.
So then when you got here, where were you living? What neighborhood?
I lived in Coney Island.
Oh, wow.
First 2.5 years and lived in New York, I lived in Gravesend, Coney Island, Avenue X and Coney Island Avenue.
Amazing.
Yeah.
That's cool.
It's great.
And did you start, did you get a job writing right away, or did you...
I moved here without a job. I had $2,000 I'd saved, which I thought I was just, like, so loaded. So loaded that we moved in, I volunteered to buy the fax machine for the house. I did, because we needed it to fax our resumes for jobs. It's true. I moved here in August of 2000, and by the end of September, I had run out of money. By the end of September, and so humiliating, and you know, whatever. I'm an idiot.
Yeah.
And but during that time, I got a job. It was a job. It was a job listing the New York Times classifieds. So it was like that, like in a newspaper. You call a phone number. I faxed my resume using the fax I bought for like $350.
Great investment.
Great investment. And got a job with this company called MJI Interactive. And we wrote news blurbs for DJs to read out on air. So like when DJs would do their entertainment news or their modern rock news, I was writing them. And so it was a newsroom. My editor-in-chief, my ultimate boss, was actually a hero of mine, this guy Ira Robbins, who created Trouser Press. Some of you may know what that is. It's like legendary music magazine, record guide in the 70s. He's super cool. He was my editor. And I would have to write 12 stories a day, each 80 words. I'd have a noon deadline and a 5 deadline, 5 p.m., and you'd start the day by scouring every newspaper looking for anything that seemed like it might be relevant news for a alternative rock listener. And then you create your list of here are the 70 possible stories. I'd send them to my editor, Spencer, and then he would tell me the 10 that seemed plausible, and then I'd have to write them up, write up all 10, and they'd choose which 6 to send out to the stations, and I would do that twice a day.
And how long did you have that grind?
2.5 years.
Wow.
I loved that job. I learned so, made me such a good writer.
It probably taught you editing, too.
What's that?
It probably taught you how to edit your...
Yeah, totally. And also, you always had to write a punny title. Always. Always. So that was always a challenge, because the head of the company... I mean, we... Like, respect to the New York Post. You know, we were, like, New York... Sure. Yeah, so you have to aspire to that.
Do you have a highlight that still sticks with you?
There is one that immediately jumps out as you asked that question. It was an interview with J-Lo. Did a lot of J-Lo news in 2001. She was, the top. And she had given an interview where she'd said that she had once spoken an interview talking about her ass. Like, she brought it up. She brought it up, and she saw that had made the conversation more prevalent, and she regretted that.
Okay.
And so my name for this story was Dairy Error. Anyway, that's the first one that comes to mind.
That's incredible.
But I had the job for 2.5 years, and then the company got bought by Clear Channel, which is one of the three largest owners of radio stations in the United States, and I got laid off shortly after that.
Yeah, redundancy, right? That's how it works. So, hey, how do you go from Dairy Error to Kickstarter? I know there's probably a gap of years in there, but
you probably told the
origin story a million times.
It honestly wasn't that long after. It was about 2 years after. In between then, I made a living writing about music. I was writing record reviews for the Village Voice, a few in Spin and places like that. You'd get paid $75 for a 200-word review. And I got to where I was doing like 5 of those things a month, and that was, that felt real. And then I got a couple day jobs during that time, really in cool ones. And then in 2005, I met someone. This guy named Perry, who we met at a restaurant where I was a regular, and he worked and hung out, and it was just a cool place to hang out, diner in Brooklyn. And he told me that he had had this idea, and so we ended up hanging out one night, and he told me about it, and it was the idea for Kickstarter. And he had had that 4 or 5 years before. He was living in New Orleans, wanted to throw a concert, and didn't have the cash to do it, and instead thought, well, what if I put the idea for the concert online? People could buy tickets, but no one would be charged unless the show sold out. And that way, like New Orleans would decide whether this show happens, right, rather than me.
There's no pressure unless you actually have to do it. Yeah.
And so that made a lot of sense to him. But he had that idea 2001. That was a very different internet. Everything was crashing. To launch a website, you needed servers and racks.
You need to know how to do Flash.
You need to know how to do things. Yeah. And so he hadn't let go of the idea. And then when we met, we just started talking about it and just started.
What year was this?
Dreaming on it together. 2005.
Okay.
So at that time, I had a day job as a managing editor of a site called eMusic, which is like an indie music subscription service. I did that for a while. And then nights and weekends was working with Perry. And then we met another friend, Charles Adler, about a year after that. Charles is a designer. And started working on that on the side. Perry and Charles were both mostly full-time on it by then. So it was like the Kickstarter launched publicly in 2009, April 2009. So it was 3.5, 4 years after our first conversations.
That's a long time to be working on something.
Yes.
But I think people assume they're like, oh yeah, Kickstarter. Yeah, that just like it happened and it took off. That's awesome. But it sounds like it wasn't that easy.
Yeah, turns out.
What was happening in those 3.5 years that kept it from launching?
Poor decisions. We weren't engineers. And right. And we.
What was that? What was Perry and Charles' background?
Perry was a day trader, artist, recording engineer. You know, you name it. Sort of shuffled through it. Mm-hmm. Charles, a graphic designer, visual designer, and then I was a music critic.
Right.
So dream team.
Dream
team. Bring on the money.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. And none of us had any entrepreneurial intentions. And this is before, being an entrepreneur is cool.
Yeah.
Right? This is before that. This is still like white stripes are cool.
Yeah, yeah.
and really, it changed. I mean, it changed. It changed. Like Julian Casablancas goes down, Mark Zuckerberg goes up, the world gets worse. So we were, we had hired hired external engineers, which everyone told us not to do. These are people I knew. So our answer to people who said, don't do this was, whatever, old man, you don't know.
Yeah.
You don't know, it's different.
Yeah.
They knew it was right.
Nobody likes to work with anybody else's code. Yeah.
Well, not even that. It's just the incentive structures are so wrong when you're having someone else build a tool that's going to keep going. So we got stuck there for a while. Got stuck in a lot of ways. Ran out of money and.
For sure.
I mean, there were just moments where the universe seems like it's just giving that message very loud and clear.
Yeah. And I'm sure there were those conversations too.
Yeah.
Were you guys just like, screw it, no, we're going to make this happen?
Well, it's just,
you know. We've been working on it for 3.5 years, got to get it out now.
It wasn't even a question of, it's just, can this happen? You know, just kept running into these obstacles. And then it all kind of unlocked. The year before we met, we met people who mattered more in the world. We met a woman in New York named Sunny Bates. We met Katarina Fake, who started Flickr. We met Andy Bayo, who started Upcoming and Waxy. And they're like, Katarina and Andy are internet luminary heroes, like our absolute idols. Our first splash page for Kickstarter was just a list of other sites that we loved. And it was just like, you know, it was Flickr, it was Mux Tape, it was Wikipedia, it was Craigslist. I forget what all was on the list.
Wait, why was the splash page other sites that you loved?
Just trying to give love. No, just give love.
Oh, okay, nice.
Like, that should be the spirit of things.
Yeah.
We need to talk more about that later in this conversation.
Okay.
I do think that's important. Yeah, so we had that. Yeah, it just didn't seem like it was going to happen. But yeah, we met better people. And then suddenly, talented people wanted to work with us because we had someone vouching for us as like, these aren't jokers,
yeah.
You know, and we would meet engineers and you'd have, you know, you talk to someone afterwards, you're like, I don't know, seems nice. Mm-hmm. Like what do we know? You know, what do we actually know?
You're not looking at their code.
And then it came together. We met in particular a guy named Lance Ivey, who once he got involved, the Kickstarter was done like 3 or 4 months later.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was amazing. And Lance was like the core of the engineering team for a decade. I mean, that was incredible. And then launched April 28th, 2009. The first project was by Perry. The second project was by he and I and another friend together.
What were those first projects?
The first project at the time, Perry was making these stenciled T-shirts. He'd gotten a stencil made and would spray paint on T-shirts. It was a silhouette of Grace Jones, and it said, Grace Jones does not give a fuck. That was the first Kickstarter project.
Did it get funded?
No. He didn't tell anybody. He didn't want to make 100 T-shirts. The second, the second project was by me and him and our friend Claudia, and this one was called New York Makes a Book, and the idea was if you pledge $30, you get a copy of a book, and you get one page of it to put whatever you want on it. So it's a 100-page book with 100 authors.
Oh, that's cool.
So did that. Yeah, that was great. We all met at La Poisson Rouge and gave the books out to everyone in person. Everyone had a name tag with their page number. Yeah,
that
was
that
really
got
fun.
Funded, yeah.
Yeah, totally. That what got funded very quickly.
How much was the goal there?
$3,000.
Okay,
it was just enough to print a book on Blurb. I used blurb.com.
Yeah.
And I did that all by myself. That was great.
So then, I met you, and I looked it up today. I found the email. We met April 2011.
Yeah.
Because you guys were just trying to get people to make stuff and put it on Kickstarter, which is funny to me now, knowing where Kickstarter is, that you hit me up to try to like put some art on Kickstarter.
Yeah.
We had a conversation about like what kind of weird, fun shit could we do, and nothing.
It didn't go anywhere.
No, I didn't. I was lazy. And I was like, who the hell are these Kickstarter guys or whatever? No, but it was... It was exciting, but I remember going to your office in what, Chinatown?
Near here. Yeah, right by here, Rivington.
Right around the corner, Rivington, yeah. There was your doorman. It was just a guy sleeping on the steps. It was scrappy, I think you'd describe it.
Sure.
Yeah, it was good. But is that what you guys did at the start? Just like, just try to find people that had projects or could have projects?
Yeah, well, I mean, it first started with, you know, if you're... I'm sure someone in this room is maybe not has been working on the same idea for at least 4 years or multiple years, and you talk about it with all your friends and you bore them silly and they like don't believe in you anymore at a certain point because you've been talking about it for too long, but you have all those conversations and that's how you realize what's interesting about what you're doing, because talking about something that doesn't exist is fascinating because you can see in someone's eyes the moment when they stop listening to you, and you're just like, oh, my shit got boring. Like, okay, think back to those last 15 seconds, strike that from this whole idea, whatever. Like, you just learn. You
yeah.
learn so much. And so we had done that forever. And so the very first project, I mean, when we started the site, was invite only. So you'd have to...
Oh, right. You used to have to be vetted.
It was invite only. Like you'd have to have like your account was enabled. You could write in and ask to have your account enabled, and if you did, you would email back and forth with me, and I would ask what you're about, et cetera. But once you got in, you then got 5 invites you could give to other people.
And what was the thinking behind that?
Just that
you wanted to make sure the projects were good, or
yeah, a little bit that, but more. You know, cultures get created so early.
Mm-hmm.
And like earlier than you think, and we always knew that like this wasn't something that could just be wide open from the start because we're trying to redefine the idea of fundraising. We're trying to create a new, you know, model, a new framework, and they have to be very intentional about the examples that are happening that way. And honestly, that remains something that we believe in. It just gets harder with scale and success.
It's really hard to scale with curation. Did the potato salad Kickstarter, did that happen during that time or after?
No, that happened way later.
That's like my favorite one ever. It was a guy who just was going to make a really large amount of potato salad.
There's a good lesson here. there is. You know, the rule was all our very initial rule for Kickstarter, my informal rule was just no bummers. I didn't want any projects that were using guilt to try to get money out of people. Just like that's the worst. You don't want that culture.
So that's why you're not doing charity and supporting people for their charities.
But like we had categories called adventure. We were into people just like messing around. Yeah. So in the early days there were a lot of projects that were in the potato salad genre. But like 5 years later, the site got more professionalized in every way. The projects were, you know, higher fidelity. We had a lot of rules and structure around how things should work. And we had been using an algorithm on the back end to sort of identify which projects were likely to be approved and which projects were likely to be declined. Because for the first 5 years, we manually reviewed every single project. That's probably 500,000 things that a person, one of 25 of us, had to read and either say yes or no to. And then if we said no, have a back and forth with the person about why we said no. And we did that for 5 years for somewhere between 300,000 and 500,000 project ideas would be my guess. And so we built an algorithm, a machine learning algorithm, that looked at every decision we had made and basically trained a version of us that is an algorithm that would look at projects the same way, and started letting that make determinations about what to do. So we had been running this for a while, and then it had been working so well that we decided to announce it. It was my decision to announce it, that here's this new way projects can happen. You know, there's now this algorithm, the human process is not as intense, it's a lot faster, you know, whatever, all those words. And then it's like a week after that, this potato salad project launches, which is a project from a guy saying, I just want to make potato salad. And then it went viral and he made 60 grand in like 3 days. And everyone's just trolling it, and 60 grand to make potato salad. And it's like international news. It happens over the 4th of July weekend. I remember where I was when I got the phone call about potato salad existing. And it's kind of a perfect storm of like you make this public change and then you pay for it. And I felt like in that I learned something about the importance of vigilance.
What do you feel like that was a negative thing? Because I think for me, when I saw that, it just made me really happy. And so your mission of no bummers is like, it had the opposite effect. Like it made me, I was just like, that's fucking awesome.
Yeah, you know? No, totally. Like, that's totally
hilarious. And he's got all this momentum. He's going to make a lot more potato salad now. He's having a picnic to give people potato salad. So I know it maybe wasn't the intention of the site, but like, I think a lot of people latched onto it. One, maybe for the stupidity, but then also for the entertainment value. And like, oh, that's like, there's something sincere about that and really delightful.
I feel all those things, and I think that is a predominant energy. But these are interesting moments because those are still choices of what do you stand for?
Right.
Do you stand for people being silly and screwing around? Okay, to what degree? Okay, what is it? How does it make someone making a record or making a painting that's on the site right now? How do they feel about that? And there's just a lot of perspectives from which to consider it. And, you know, and the dominant narrative of just one of like, this is fun. And, you know, you face this question of being in on the joke or not. And in retrospect, I think the decision to let it, you know, to allow it to continue funding for all the reasons you're saying was speaking to what the energy was at the moment, rather than thinking about what is the energy that always must be here.
Right.
And those are challenging things because it's, you know, yeah, I don't know. They're just real moments of conflict and tension of you know, your values and the real world colliding.
Was that some of the biggest press you'd gotten up until that point? Or had you gotten other bigger
press? I think I'll brush my shoulders. We had been at that level for a while. I mean, there were many, you know, we'd had a major controversy. We averaged at least one or two a year. They always happen on holiday weekends. Like really, me and the rest of the comms team, we would joke about that before holiday weekends. We'd like look each other in the eye and be like,
"Which is going to go down?"
Yeah, talk to you tomorrow. Yeah, something's going to happen, and it would. It always would.
And then what were the moments? So if you said you had been at that level for a while, what was the turning point between like asking people to please do a project on Kickstarter to where, oh, we feel confident this has got some momentum now?
Well, I mean, I don't think the first energy ever stops. I don't think you can ever let that abate. I mean, people get tired and other people have to come in that have the energy to have that. But I think that energy always has to be there. The site really went mainstream at the start of 2012 when the first projects crossed $1 million. There were two that crossed it on the same day, February 9th, 2012, a day I remember crystal clear. One was called Double Fine Adventure. It was a video game from a beloved video game maker. It had raised $1 million in the first 24 hours of its project, and the whole internet was watching. People were refreshing it to see when it was going to hit $1 million. We were doing the same. We hadn't built the site thinking about this, so everyone had refresh and then wait 2 minutes for the site to reload. We were like watching it on the projector at work nearby here, and we're all like have champagne. And meanwhile, in the back of the office are the three back-end engineers keeping the site up while we're all oblivious. You know,
just like,
where's Brett? Where's Aaron? Why aren't they partying? Those guys suck. You know, no, they're the only reason this is working right now.
Yeah, exactly.
But once you become, you know, at that moment we became something fundamentally new, like, you know, the people's lottery ticket. Anybody with a compelling idea could become a millionaire overnight. And, you know, that happened in game shows, but, you know, hadn't happened in a way that was so wide open. And, yeah, that's a big deal.
What was the second project?
The second project was an iPhone dock. There you go. Elevation Dock, it was called.
And then,
very nice guy.
What, do you have any other favorite projects that were coming around that, you know, just like kind of pay home with you? I follow you on Kickstarter, and I know you back a lot of projects.
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
The fact that you can afford to still is impressive because you back like thousands of projects.
Yeah, I started looking at that at one point, and then... And then thought, huh.
My wife did that too at mine. Huh. She was like, how many Kickstarter projects are you backing?
Yeah.
You don't even open this stuff anymore.
Well, you know, I'm a softie. When I was this, you know, I was a CEO of Kickstarter from 2014 through last year. Mm-hmm. And then during then and any time before, I don't know, I look at a great project and I'm like, how do I not support this person? Yeah. Like, doesn't this whole thing depend on someone like me making a choice like this, you know? And so I always just modeled that behavior and just, you know, always tried to be in that mindset of just being excited about people's ideas. And, you know, it wasn't hard. I really came to experience Kickstarter as a very direct culmination of all these things I had done before. You know, that being a music writer and trying to reflect back culture and shape culture by creating a context around it, that Kickstarter was very similar, just earlier in the process.
Well, talking about being a writer in your past life, like, I know, so my co-founder Adam and I were both art directors and creative directors. When we started a business, we don't really know what we're doing. And I think it sounds like from your guys' background, it's not like any of you guys really went to business school or anything. How do you feel like, did you feel like that was an advantage when trying to start a community around creative people and creative ideas as far as credibility or as far as understanding your audience, or were there more challenges than benefits for that?
Well, it's really, you know, it's hard to know the counterfactual because I, you know, I've only lived this life so far that I know of. I believe in everything, by the way. That's my rule. I believe in everything.
I believe in everything is a good rule.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. Totally. It's the only thing that makes sense. Either believe in everything or believe in nothing. And believing in everything seems way more fun. Yeah. Anyway, what was your question?
About your like starting a company as creative people who maybe don't know what they're doing.
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, I probably downplay our skills a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, you play down.
So do we.
Just in, you know, Charles had been in big agencies before, you know, had worked in a lot of different contexts. At my last two jobs, one at Flavor Pill, one at eMusic, I was quickly rose to lead teams and found that, like, strategic thinking was something that I weirdly liked because it was so foreign. Mm-hmm. When I discovered that I was good at those kinds of things, it really messed with me because I just thought, like, no, I'm a writer. Mm-hmm. I don't wanna know how to do this. Like, I felt wrong. You know, that line was that clear to me because, you know, I'm reading All the President's Men. It's like, keep the advertisers out of our newsroom. You know, yeah. Ben Bradley slamming the door. Like, that's that's the attitude. And honestly, still is my attitude. But so being good at that was really unnerving, but useful. And so, you know, it ends up being about so many things, but, like, you know, having the clarity to know what you're trying to do and just being able to get other people excited and thinking about it the way you think about it. And I look at starting things as being so, so wonderful in their clarity. It's always really clear what to do. You know, maybe there's a question of how do you do it, but, like, what to do is obvious. What happens after existence and even what happens after success, in my experience, is a lot more difficult. I mean, I think every stage continues to get more and more difficult because it becomes a question of what to do. It's, you know, it's the reason why there's so many great first records and so many, you know, meaningless second records. And it's a really interesting shift that you have to make in yourself. So that, you know, that I think is really interesting.
Well, it does seem like that was born out of, and, you know, similar to what we did with Working Not Working. We built a product for ourselves and the people that we know because we knew it was a problem and you're trying to solve a problem. So Perry trying to get, you know, a concert funded and then other like-minded people, it's easy to go and put it out into your people and see if it sticks.
But I think the thing, you know, for me, what was really important to us and it was the only way we could go about Kickstarter was to do those things, trying to learn how to do things right, like not wanting to be a shit show, like, you know, wanting some level of competence. I was going to say professionalism, not professionalism, competence. And but to still be ourselves about it and to not adopt the culture and values of the world we were stepping into, you know, to stay separate from that. You know, like my hero in thinking has always been Kurt Cobain to me, and this idea that selling out is the worst thing you could ever do, and you know, watching him struggle with that, seeing in his lyrics, and obviously in what happened in his life, just, like, felt so true. Yeah.
Did you guys have a lot of opportunities to sell out, and how did you keep from doing
sure.
that?
Sure. You keep from doing it by you just tell everyone from the very beginning that you're not going to do that, and then you just bind yourself to your intention.
Was part of that becoming a public benefit corporation part of that?
Yeah, for sure.
Can you explain what that is? Because I still kind of only get it.
Yeah, you're not alone. A modern American for-profit corporation, your Expectation, according to the business zeitgeist, is to maximize shareholder value. Your job is to make as much profit as possible. A public benefit corporation is a type of company that's been around for about 4 years now. And it is legally required to balance its search for shareholder value with producing a positive good for society. It's legally required, so it's meant to have some teeth to it. Patagonia and Kickstarter are the two most well-known companies to have done it. I think there are more that have done it since. But it's a way to try to bind yourself to a different goal. And to make it lasting. It's not just because your management at this point in time, you know, got woke at Burning Man. You know, it's like it's locked in, and that's the idea. That's a tool, and it's a tool. It changed some things about how we operate. I think more it like gave a name to how we operate.
We'd be behaving in that way before.
Yeah, but even that's you know, but I. You know, I have a side goal that I'm going to... I think we have the wrong leadership heroes, the wrong business and leadership heroes. I think artists should be our leadership heroes. I think they make more interesting choices. I think they face more interesting decisions. I think their experience is more relevant to the world today than what past business leaders have experienced. But that's another project.
Yeah. Well, we should dive into a little of that though, because you were telling me earlier that you left Kickstarter last year, at the end of last year, and you just mulled around for a while, trying to figure out what you're going to do next. And so what are you doing now?
Well, I just want to give the first thing I did,
yeah.
Just a piece of advice. First thing I did was I went and I saw an astrologist. And I got like a 3-hour reading, you know, the deep chart, and amazing. You walk out of that and you're like, I am chosen, you know. the planets came together,
yeah.
And they created me
at the right time.
You're welcome. Oh, yeah. And yeah, you're
I'm
just
Leo
like
rising. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. You're just. It's cosmic, you know, whatever you want, it's cosmic. It's just, it's a great thing to do for your self-esteem. And she gave me my luckiest days of the year, days to be in nature, days, whatever. And
did she
like,
tell you it was February 9th?
No. But you know, I've done everything she said, because why not? Like,
no one else is
giving me tips, you know, whatever. I'll do what the lady says to say, be in nature on December 22nd. All right, I'm there. So anyway, I did that.
Yeah.
Like truly awesome, and then I ended up spending. I had this flash of like during Kickstarter, I'd spend a lot of time planning, you know, like strategic planning, thinking about where we should go, imagining different futures, whatever. And I just thought I should treat myself like I'm a company. And so I did like 2 weeks of strategic planning on Yancey Inc., Yancey PBC, and just thought about what it could be, and just looked at everything in my history, you know, just went through all these different, like, totally nerdy, eye-rolling sort of frameworks that I would do with, you know, a leadership team. And yeah, it was great, and found clarity on you know, a number of things, and found real clarity on what it was I needed to do, which was to write a book, and so I'm doing that, and I've been doing that full time for 5 months now. I feel so afraid of saying what
it's
my
probably
idea
not
is.
The book people expect.
Yeah,
because I would expect.
My book idea.
Start my life.
Yeah, I'll just say it very quickly. Yeah. You know, once you hear what my life is like now, you'll understand why I feel so awkward sharing anything. but yeah, my goal is to challenge the dominance of financial maximization as the driving force of society, and to suggest that within 30 years we can change that, and that. That's a type of generational change that happens all the time, and it's thinking about how that could be possible. So that's the book.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's terrifying. It's terrifying, and Yeah, so had that idea, had this whatever, like it's a thing I've been thinking about for a long time and just sort of had a way to think about it, and I like made a book proposal, I got a book agent,
So someone's on board for this and now you have pressure.
And I have to do it. Well, one interesting thing, just like meeting potential literary agents, I met some very nice people who were encouraging the Kickstart Your Life book, and then I met one person who was really skeptical of me and I signed with him. Yeah, because I thought, I need to win him over. And that's how I will always know I'm like what I'm doing is any good. And that was definitely a good decision. Cool. That was definitely a good decision.
So that challenge, yeah.
Yeah, you have to create friction for yourself. So what's interesting is, yeah, so I'm writing a book. That's my job. I have a deadline at the end of the year. And... You know, I experienced this as CEO. The hardest parts of these jobs are managing yourself, are managing your emotions, are managing being mad at yourself for screwing things up because you're going to screw things up all the time, and I would experience these often as CEO. And then in my writing life, I sublet an apartment a few blocks from me, like a 15-minute walk from me, some guy that's away for a few months. I asked him to disconnect the internet, and so I just go there every day for 8 hours and have no internet all day, and I'm just sitting in this tiny, empty shoebox studio apartment, and I'm just there with things all over the walls, and that's it, just me and my thoughts and creating all day long. And early on, as I was doing that, my first day of like being there, truly isolated, like deeply, deeply isolated.
Which is very different from your life from the past 10 years. Or
yes,
so, right?
Yes.
Being it could, in a company around people.
Yeah, it could not be more opposite. Yeah. It was really hard. The second day, I didn't want to go in. Third day, I really didn't want to go in because I could feel that I was already going deeper than I felt comfortable, and I'd only been there 2 days. Yeah. I'm like, Jesus.
it's like being in the woods and growing
this
a beard.
Going?
But you just grew a mustache. So it's moderated.
We need to talk about the mustache. The mustache was an important part of this. And so I started having these spirals like I would have as a CEO of like the same frustrations. And I realized, but I'm the only one here.
Yeah.
I'm the only one here. Jesus. Jesus. And so I shifted my mindset. And I shifted my mindset from, instead of thinking about, like, I'm going to go there every day and I'm going to write 4% of a great book today, whatever, like demanding that. Instead, I thought I shouldn't demand anything of myself. I shouldn't demand any type of performance. Like, writing a book is really hard. Like, brilliant people have done terrible jobs at it before. Like, you know, enter this with total humility. And I can't demand that I do a great job of writing every day, but I can demand that I am present every day. I can demand that every day I'm here, that I don't, like, whatever, use my phone to cheat, that I'm, like, working, that I'm here, and that if I trust in that, that good things will come. And that has just been my attitude each day. And it's just sort of letting it come to you, letting it, you know, being with it, not forcing it, not being upset when you are unable to produce the way you imagine your mythical version of yourself is able to produce, but just creating forgiveness. And that was not something I did as a CEO. I don't think you really can. But, you know, here working on a single thing for 18 months, like, I just saw there's going to be no other way, or I'm just going to burn myself out or whatever. It just creates something terrible out of, you know, self-hate of this process or something.
Yeah, so it's creating that structure and then also being kind to yourself at the same time.
Yeah, well, it's just, I don't know. For me, that was real eye-opening, this idea of, like, I can't demand that I write well, but I can demand that I'm in the chair. And that, like, that's the job.
Yeah.
And that just created a real shift in me for how I felt about the work and, yeah, what attitude I brought to it and whatever. I mean, I'll still probably create a terrible book, but I'm trying to be.
But why is that topic
trying to do it right?
Why is that topic so important to you?
That's a great question. I think it's a product of the culture, the moment I'm in. And I don't think we can change the forces that are happening in the world, but I think it's very possible to change the contexts that they exist within. And in reality, the context is all there is. Like, these things are all neutral. And so I think we fight a lot of one-on-one battles of like whack-a-mole of 20 different things at once, but maybe there's just a deeper attitude adjustment or subtle change that could have more impact. And so it's just something I've always thought about, and I'd been giving a talk for a couple of years that touched on this, that I could feel people connected with and people would ask about, and I just thought, all right, I have an idea to work towards of something beyond our current idea of capitalism, and because of what I've done before, people will hear me out more than some other random person.
So do you think it's a reaction to the way that the world is changing, in the sense that, you know, we talk about automation and we talk about universal basic income and stuff like that? Do you feel like that stuff is inevitable, so that's what the future you're leaning towards and you're kind of putting this in context of? Or do you not agree with that? Like, do you feel like?
Yeah, I think our thinking about the future is pretty wrong, but it's always a safe thing to say, right? you can never be proven wrong for saying that. But universal basic income, the idea that we should all just get 10 grand a month or whatever, sounds great for not working. Where's that free money choice? I don't believe in that, because I think that presupposes that we've run out of things to do. And I see a world that's more broken than ever. And, you know, we have to start by digging ourselves out of all of the terrible choices we've made in the past. So, you know, to me, that's based on this idea that we're going to run out of work. And I just think, when is that supposed to happen? You know, the number one complaint on airplanes 20 years ago was probably about how bad the food is, and now it's about the Wi-Fi being slow. So now the biggest problem is something that didn't exist 20 years ago. So, like, we will create new things that create new problems that, you know, whatever. Anyone that does laundry for a family, you know, it just doesn't stop. So, I just don't think that's realistic. I think that what we should think about is, what is the work that needs to be done? Like, what is valuable? What are all the ways to think about value? And how could we match our energy against those things? And there's tremendous power in being able to sync a strategic goal with a mass of people working towards something together. And, yeah, we shouldn't give up on that.
Well, at the beginning you said about giving love, and we need to be giving love more. What did you mean by that?
I hope for a new spirit of competition.
Like the Celtics beating the Rockets in the finals, or
dreaming is great too. No, dreams are wonderful. John and Paul are collaborators and competitors, right? They push each other. Paul writes yesterday. John's like, oh fuck, you know, I gotta do something. They push each other, but from the very beginning, they make this agreement that all their songs will have both their names, because they're like, we want to compete, but we can sense that they're, you know, we could sense the problems there. Mm-hmm. So smart, like such a smart way of thinking about things. So I think that there's a different sort of energy of pushing each other, but that isn't zero sum. That understands that, yeah, the world is not winner take all, it's collaborate and make more. And that all evidence shows that that's the case. And we just have yet to shift the world in a way that reflects that. And this is the moment. This is the moment. This is like first post-internet generations. This is the moment where that starts to happen. Or it can happen, you know, if we're thinking about it, if we're looking at it, if we have an idea. And so those are things that I think we have to have. There just have to be conversations about, because if you're not thinking about it, then you just keep going with the tide, going up and down with whatever's happening, rather than, you know, charting an actual destination. But these are scary things to think about, and intimidating things to think about imaginary futures, and that I'm going to put my name on this shit, and whatever, people are going to judge that. And um, And I had a moment of being really frustrated and afraid, and I was complaining to my wife about this, and my wife was just had it, and she's like, well, whatever it is, you just have to find a way to not be like this, because you're not going to get there like this. You know, that same day I went to see the astrologist, my last day, or my first day after Kickstarter, I went to McNally Jackson to look at books because I wanted to get a self-help book. I thought, whatever, I want something about change. You know, give me something. The mistier the cover, the better. And didn't see anything, but then saw on another bookshelf, there was a Beatles book called Beatles 1966. And in 1966 was the year the Beatles released Rubber Soul, wrote, recorded, and released Revolver, and wrote and recorded Sgt. Pepper's, all in 1 year. So the arguably the greatest artistic transformation anyone has ever made. And this book is a monthly diary of what they did. So yeah, what the hell is somebody doing when that's happening? Well, you can find out. And it makes you love Paul all the more. And there was a moment, they had their first vacation. It was after Revolver. They had their first vacation since becoming Beatles, like 3 months off. They all did different things. And
so within this year that they did, were that prolific, they also took 3 months off.
Maybe 6 weeks. But yeah, they had their first vacation.
Yeah.
And so Paul decides that he wants to drive across Spain by himself. And so to do that, he slicks back his hair and he grows a mustache because he wants to be incognito. He doesn't want to be Paul McCartney. And it works. And he drives across Spain and no one knows who he is. And so when he gets back to London, he calls the other Beatles and he tells them about what happened. And
about the mustache?
About the mustache, that he had gone on this trip and that people hadn't known what he was. And he had already thought a step ahead. And he said, so we can't make a Beatles record. We all need to be someone else. It's going to be too hard to make a Beatles record. We need to be someone else. Everyone needs to change their appearance, have a new name. We need to be someone else. And this was the inspiration for Sgt. Pepper's. And so that, you know, that device of him for Paul, a mustache on a road trip across Spain, just like unlocked this other thing for him. And so when my wife said to me, you need something, this isn't working for you, my immediate thought was, I'm going to grow a mustache. I want to be like Paul.
Yeah.
I want to
unlock it.
I want to remind myself that I'm not myself. I want to create a separation from myself and the world around me. And people with mustaches look like they have secrets. And I think the book I'm writing, needs to have that thought.
So it's almost putting yourself in character to write this book.
Entirely, yeah. For this year, I will have this. Whether I have it after this year, I don't know. But yeah, no, that is.
I love that you.
That is intentionally true.
And the first thing I said to you, I was like, "What are you, incognito?" And you're like, "Yeah, I am."
These are things you have to think about. You know, you can't just say, "I'm going to do this." Like, we are our behavior.
It's so easy to be habitual. It's so easy to keep doing the things the way we've always been doing them, and you kind of need moments or devices or practices to snap you out of those. So if it's a mustache or if it's meditation or if it's going to an astrologist or whatever it is, it's helpful to break yourself from those habits.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's totally. It's having the self-awareness and it's giving a shit enough about the quality of what you do to invest the energy to push yourself. And it's hard to do on your own. It's much easier to do with a lot of people around you. Well, it's also easy to hide there too, but you know, external pressure works wonders. But that's what it takes. Cause it's, you know, it's so like what I, probably the thing I've learned more than anything else is just how hard it is to do anything well, anything. You know, like cultures pursuing mastery of the smallest things. Like, I get it. Because at a certain point, you just think, why do anything half-assed? You know, and you just learn to respect the work, and you just learn to slow down and do fewer things. And there's a great Erland Oyes song. It's like, do less or commit to less or do more, right? And like, that's your choice. So, be really respecting that, you know, humbling yourself in front of things, like thinking about the centuries of people who have tried to do the thing you're doing. And yeah, you know, we want to tell ourselves these things are easy, so we feel motivated to go through with it, but also that's going to ultimately produce shitty work that no one's going to care about. Yeah. So I think you really have to humble yourself. Like, you have to get down on your belly and eat shit before you can start to have anything real to say.
That's amazing. I only have two last questions. What does success look like to you?
I think it's a, you know, it involves some form of leadership, either leading through ideas or just helping a group of people get somewhere that's great for everyone to get. But that's what most drives me. And then, you know, my family is so deeply integrated into my life. Like, I don't even, like, yeah, that obviously is at the center of it. But yeah, it's through leadership, being an advocate for ideas, making things possible. I was just at like a 2-week education program, and at the end you had to write like your motto, your slogan, your purpose. And mine was to help people see the Matrix, and I want to also help people do something about it.
Yeah, that's amazing. I remember we had a conversation a couple months ago, and you said that's like the thing. Once you see the Matrix, then you can start to see 5 steps ahead and be able to really take control of your life and what you're doing.
Well, I just had this experience of, as maybe you can feel, you know, how Kickstarter entered my life, but you know, experiencing a ripple in the universe that had something to do with something I'd done, which was really wild. And one of the wild experiences was I kept waiting for like the guy in charge that has the rubber stamp to say, you know, allowed, not allowed, to come stop by and tell us whether we were doing okay, you know. And this idea that it's that wide open, that the only difference between Kickstarter, like, before it launched or when it first launched and later, it was just people believing that it was real. Mm-hmm. Like, that was the only thing that changed, was the belief of other people's minds. And that, yeah, I'm just like, that's crazy that that's how things are. Like, it shouldn't be like that. Someone should be in charge here. You know, I felt alarmed.
Yeah.
And then you just realize, okay, that's what everything is then. Okay. So then everyone has a feeling, okay. And then, yeah, you start to process that. And think, what do you want to do with that? And yeah.
The last question. How are you feeling right now?
You know, like, I'm talking too much. I don't know. Good, yeah, I'm happy, I'm great. It's a funny time to be doing an interview because 2 weeks from today I leave New York, or 2 weeks from tomorrow, after living here for 18 years, leaving. I may be back, I don't know, but yeah, it's
where
an interesting
going?
Moment. Some mix of either Vancouver or LA, we're not sure which, but yeah, West Coast. Yeah. My wife's family is from Vancouver, so we'll be there some, and then, you know, I've never had nice weather, and my brother lives in LA. So we don't know yet, but
doing it.
Well,
that's cool. Well, thank you, Yancey. Thanks. All right, we've got a couple minutes for Q&A. Does anybody have any questions? Any questions here? I'm going to give you the mic so it gets on the podcast.
Okay, well, thank you, first of all, because that was really amazing. I guess my question is, if you take Kickstarter Yancey and now Yancey, in this day and age, launching a TV or web series or just a series, let's put it that way, what are like the 3 biggest things that you'd recommend?
To launching a series.
Yeah, or getting funding for one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting, you know, it's interesting. That is an interesting question. You know, be on CBS, ABC, or NBC, I guess. No, I'm kidding. Well, you know, it feels like maybe it's after the gold rush a little bit in those fields, like Amazon pulling back on funding. You know, we had that period of 3 years where any idea could get funded. Whenever you have those periods, it's like, get that money because it's going to go away. Now it's happening for podcasts. The wave will just keep shifting. So, you know, those moments are like harder times to go and do something. Also can be more interesting times to try and do things. But yeah, I mean, you know, of course I should say you should do a Kickstarter project if you're making a web series as many people do, but, yeah, I don't know. I mean, it seems like it's such a crowded field. It's all about being able to draw eyeballs, I would imagine, through a YouTube channel, something like that. But I did find that period of so much television being made interesting because I'm old enough to remember when the big concern was about everybody watching too much TV. And then we just stopped caring about that 15 years ago, which just means we gave up. And now it's like, you know, oh, 80 new hours got put on Netflix today, and people are celebrating. And I'm like, where are the people that are like, think of all the shit that's not happening now because of some stupid TV show.
And nobody's reading books.
Think of all the hours of knowledge accumulation or productivity or fellowship that are lost to this shit. You know,
you say and that, it's great, and I love it. TV, you know, so I'm like, that's awesome.
But
just
but
sit
that's,
there and come at me.
Yeah, it's a problem, man. Yeah. It's a problem.
Yeah. Any other questions?
Hey, how's it going?
What up?
When you first met Perry and he presented the Kickstarter idea to you, what made you say yes to joining the project? Did it align to your values? Was it monetary? Altruistic.
Our very first conversation, I did not like the idea. I think my immediate response was like, American culture, American Idol is terrible for making culture. Like, why would we do that on the internet? And then, you know, we kept talking about it and quickly got into subcultures and, you know, started talking about the things we really loved and like, yeah, of course I would put up, you know, $50 for a David, you know, for David Lynch to make a movie if he got to have one less dinner with like an oligarch to make to make some difficult movie, that oligarch would be like, what? What did I do? So that, you know, that really inspired. But what, you know, what drew me in, you know, just meeting a friend, a like-minded person, and just being excited about making something. I mean, to a degree that's like stupid. I never cared about like the ownership or money or any, you know, any of those parts. Like those things were just never as important as like actualizing this thing to being what it should be. And I feel so grateful that that is my orientation, because I have friends who have different orientations, and it's I think it's a harder one when you know, money is your scoreboard. But yeah, the very first time I heard it, I didn't like it. Yeah, I remember it well, yeah.
So I'm curious, so when you talk about the book that you're working on right now, it's interesting to me because in a way, Kickstarter seems to be, it's like a form of financial optimization. It's a way of making capitalism work better and making people who have money able to get the thing they want with that money. So I'm curious if you have any thoughts on how Kickstarter inspired what you're working on now.
Yeah, it was very intentional. You know, it was always important to us that there never be a financial upside on Kickstarter projects. And that was illegal for a while. That law changed a few years ago. But to us, the important idea was to create a universe where ideas could be funded without any profit motivation or justification. That the classic story for any creative project is, here's a great idea. Okay, how are we gonna get people to pay money for it? Okay, how do we create some commercial component out of this through which to justify its existence? And that projects get warped and screwed up through that that demand, and that there should be a universe where an idea didn't have to fulfill any sort of profit-seeking motive, but could, its only motive could be existence. And that was the idea to try to solve. Now, with that came, yeah, all sorts of like market efficiencies of pre-market activities, and you know, it is its own economic universe that literally academics study. But for us, it was just about justifying an idea without a profit motive. That felt like the key thing that was so different from the world now. So, I still think I'm on that train, you know, and just thinking about it in just a lot of different ways.
That's great. One last question, if anybody has one.
You guys obviously birth like a whole industry around crowdfunding. What was the role of company culture in keeping competitors at bay and kind of keeping you guys as like the marquee leader?
Yeah, for the most part, we didn't care, and I think that was great. You don't lose through competition. You lose from lack of relevance to an audience. You know, either you were never relevant to begin with, or the story changed in the market and you didn't. But I don't think it's just. I think it's rarely that someone else is like eating your lunch. There are certain types of businesses, sales-oriented businesses, where that can happen. But I generally don't think that's the case. You know, I think you need to understand your competitors. You need to understand the things that they're better at than you are, because that's just free information. I think you have to learn how to think about them and deal with them without any emotion or anxiety, that it's like fairly neutral information, because it's very easy to make really poor decisions when it comes down to anything that is in relation to someone else like that. Like, you're your own worst enemy at those things. And so, you know, and I think that just takes a confidence and like, you know, we're doing our thing, you know, like you can have a street corner with four specialty grocery stores all in that same corner if they're all like focused on their thing. You know, you can't have four 7-Elevens on one corner, but if you're really clear on what you're about, that audience is there, and then that competition becomes less relevant. Yeah, you know, like another way of thinking about it, you know, the way a hierarchical organization or more highly structured organization experiences change in terms of a market or any sort of change, is as stress. You know, it like pushes the machine to the limit. Things start to break. Like, it's a very stressful environment. A more organic organization, one that has that more sees itself as a part of an ecosystem or part of a universe, it experiences change as information. It's just, hey, here's where things are shifting. Do we want to be aligned with that change or not aligned with that change? And you know, you shouldn't be aligned with every change. It's like, you know, Aerosmith was cool for doing Walk This Way because they were still Aerosmith in the video. It's not like they were trying to be Run DMC too, right? Like, you still have to be you. But, you know, just sort of understanding how the context changes what it means to be you. But I think all this just starts with a really clear self-awareness of what you are and what you're about. And if you're really clear on that, then, you know, sacrificing certain markets that a competitor will go to, those you grow to feel proud of, because you know that actually that's just you fulfilling your story. Like, and to achieve anything takes enormous sacrifice, and the power comes to people who take the time to think about what the sacrifice is going to be and actually stick to it. So I would say if you know what you're about and you know what you want, that should just be noise/helpful tips for better ways to do some things. Yeah.
That's so good. Thank you. All right, guys. That's it. We'll stick around for another drink.
Thank you all.
Maybe we want another drink. And thank you so much for coming out.
Damn, that was so good. I can't wait to do a follow-up once he gets that book past his skeptical literary agent. It sounds like it'll be really, really inspiring. Thank you so much to Yancey Strickler for joining us. If you enjoyed this Overshare, please subscribe to ensure you get our future episodes and they're released every 2 weeks. Also, rate and review us to help other people discover Overshare. We need your help to climb those Apple Podcast charts, so please give us a rate and a review. We really appreciate it. Thanks to the folks at Lucky Jack's on Orchard Street in New York City for hosting us, to Jared Nangle for recording the live audio at the event, and thanks to Working Out Working's multi-talented designer, Gabby D'Amato, for editing this episode. The Overshare theme song is Let It Grow by Caleb Grow. You can follow us on our brand new Overshare Instagram and Twitter channels at Overshare Talks to find more content and info about our live events. And if you'd like to learn more about Working Not Working and join as a creative or to hire amazing creatives, check us out at workingnotworking.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and we will see you next time.